Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Juan Francisco Matamoros Sanin, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Eleanor Nutt about her new book, Identity and Citizenship in Crimea and Moldova. Dr. Nutt, welcome to the show. I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Hi, everybody. So I am a political scientist, at least by PhD training. And I work as an assistant professor in the Department of Methodology in Qualitative Methods at LSE, London School of Economics. As I said, I'm a political scientist by training, but I often think of myself as more kind of in the boundaries of political science, just because A, I take a qualitative approach, and B, I take a kind of bottom-up approach. So I'm really engaged in kind of interpretive methods and not looking so much at what states do, but how people interact with states. And in a way, like, there are kind of synergies then with the way that I approach political science and sociology and anthropology, even though I'm not a kind of full-scale ethnographer per se.
That's really interesting. I think all of that of what you're saying manifests in the book. So I would like to go in depth about on it on the introduction of the first chapter. Could you tell us about that, please?
So the first chapter of the book kind of sets out the premise and kind of, you know, why am I interested in studying these questions of identity and citizenship in Moldova and Crimea? And it comes from the perspective that really in the last 20, 25 years, at least in the kind of post-Soviet region and post-communist region, what we've observed is more and more people becoming citizens of states that they don't reside in, but where those states are claiming them as co-ethnic. And in particular, what has been underexplored is citizens in states or polities or subnational entities who are a majority and are still becoming citizens of external states that claim them as co-ethnic. And so the book is, in the introduction, also framing kind of this concept of kin majorities and moving away from just studying how states claim external co-ethnic communities as minorities, and also say we need to look at instances when they claim co-ethnic communities that are also majorities, kin majorities. Because I think kin majorities are interesting because the scale of citizenship acquisition can be a lot larger and a lot more meaningful. And at the same time, they don't necessarily face the same threats of discrimination, which is not to say that they aren't discriminated, but I think they in general, face a kind of a lower threat of discrimination. And yet they're still kind of acquiring citizenship en masse. So in the last 20 years, around 1 million Moldovan citizens have acquired Romanian citizenship. And Crimea is also assumed to be a case where a lot of people prior to Russia's annexation in 2014 had already been what is described as kind of passportized, where it's kind of assumed that Russia had given out a lot of Russian passports to people. And so the book is a kind of comparison of these two cases and also a problematization of, like, was Crimea really passportized? Because I think the lens of passportization kind of denies any agency to individuals. It just assumes that states are giving things out without understanding the process of acquisition, the meaning of acquisition, and if people want it or need it in the first place. So actually the book ends up arguing that, yeah, Moldova is a case of kind of en masse acquisition of Romanian citizenship, but Crimea prior to Russia's annexation in 2014 really isn't a case of en masse acquisition of Russian citizenship, and then kind of looks at how and why that might be the case.
That's really interesting. I think it's an outline of the book in general, and it's a different approach conceptually and methodologically to discussions around identity and citizenship. Now, could you tell about your second chapter, Kin State Politics Through the Identity-Citizenship Nexus?
Mm-hmm. Before that, I should probably also, talk a little bit about the methodology, which is contained in the first chapter, which, and you said it is a bit different, and I think it's a bit different for many reasons, partly because it's taken in an interpretive approach in political science, which again has those kind of synergies with more sociological and anthropological approaches. But it is also doing so in a comparative way. And at least in political science, I mean, this is a kind of growing approach, but looking from the bottom up across cases is definitely kind of a different way of doing things, not studying kind of comparison through studying outcomes, but comparison through studying meanings and practices, which is basically what the book is trying to do. Which leads me on to studying, to talking about the identity citizenship nexus. So what I'm interested in terms of identity is that bottom-up perspective. How do people negotiate, navigate, understand what identity means for them? In relation to, you know, what does it mean to be Romanian in Moldova? What does it mean to be Moldovan in Moldova? How do people engage with Romania as a consequence and in relationship to that identity? What does it mean to be Russian in Crimea? What does it mean to be Ukrainian in Crimea? What does it mean to be Crimean? And how do people understand and navigate and negotiate their understanding of what Russia is as a kin state? So I'm interested in kind of meanings of identification, and then also practices of citizenship. So rather than seeing, again, citizenship through a kind of state lens about what states are giving out or what policies exist at the state level, I'm interested in that bottom-up perspective of looking at how people use citizenship, how they access it, how they acquire it, what they do as a result, what are their kind of motivations for acquiring and engaging with citizenship. And I kind of try to bring these two things together through this identity citizenship nexus. Because the kind of the key theoretical argument of the book is that we shouldn't assume that there is a relationship from identity to citizenship or from citizenship to identity, but more that there's a kind of bi-directional, messy, complex, plural way in which identity and citizenship can intersect. That's why I describe it as a nexus. So for some people, it might be that understandings of identity and practices of citizenship are nested within each other, so they're not mutually exclusive. They're kind of overlapping, and to be a part of one thing is imagined to be a part of a bigger thing. For some people, they might be kind of partially overlapping, but not wholly overlapping. So they're not kind of imagined as nested, but they kind of have a meaning, an understanding of meanings of identification that has some degree of overlap. For other people, they might be entirely separate, that to identify with one thing is conceived as entirely separate to identifying with another thing, say Ukraine or Russia. And then for other people, they might be kind of mutually exclusive, that there's almost this idea of competition between identifying as one thing and identifying as another thing. And so I try to look at that kind of messy plurality of how and when and why citizenship and identity might intersect in different ways.
Yes, it's very interesting because it talks about how identity is fractured, contingent, and it's also blended, multidimensional. And I would like you to go in depth on chapter 3, Crimea and Moldova as kin majorities. I believe it's really related to what you're saying. Just go in more in depth on it. Could you tell us about that chapter, please?
Yeah, certainly. So the third chapter It's a kind of historical exploration of how and why these two kin majorities or cases of kin majorities, Crimea and Moldova, came to be kin majorities. And so in the kind of the first part of chapter three, I explore kind of Crimea's history in relationship to Russia and Ukraine. Kind of exploring the territorial political contestations over time, exploring how and why Crimea came, you know, Crimea's kind of position in the Soviet Union, and then the contestations over Crimea's position in post-Soviet Ukraine after 1991. I look at secessionist and irredentist movements around 1994 and how and why they failed to lead Crimea from leaving Ukraine and joining Russia, and how that was a kind of apex moment of secessionist and irredentist sentiment and kind of fell away after 1994, and kind of juxtapose that with the almost surprising then annexation of Crimea by Russia in 2014. And then I look at the kind of policy level in terms of what was available or kind of how Russia was engaging with ethnic Russians abroad, kind of outside Russia's territory. And look at the compatriot policy, because that's kind of how Russia conceives of its kin communities abroad, through the kind of lens of compatriots and claims to who a compatriot is, and how the compatriot policy then plays out in the Russian policy sphere and also on the ground within Crimea. And then I move on to look at kind of the similar contestations territorially, politically, historically within Moldova, and kind of how the contemporary Moldovan state came into being through first being a part of the Russian Empire, then being a part of Greater Romania in the interwar period, then being in the Soviet Union, and then being an independent nation state since 1991. And again, look at, very similar to Crimea, the kind of existential questions that were around what Moldova was as a nation and a state in the early 90s. And how, again, in 1994, there was a kind of moment of potential unification or reunification with Romania, and how that kind of dissipated, and how people became, in a sense, less interested with ethnic politics from the bottom up, even though there was a kind of strong continued politicization of ethnicity and national questions within Moldova up to this kind of present day. And then I look very similarly to Russia at what policies existed or exist from Romania to Moldovan citizens, and kind of how Romania, in a sense, functions not just as a kin state to citizens of Moldova, but also to the whole state of Moldova, and how that makes Moldova quite different in its relationship to Romania, and how it makes Moldovan citizens quite different in relation to Romania. Because whereas Russia has kind of many communities of compatriots abroad, Romania does too, but it kind of prioritizes its largest community in Moldova in terms of scholarship places and other policies. And in particular, with regard to Romania's policy of citizenship acquisition, or how Romania terms it, kind of Romania's policy of citizenship reacquisition, on the basis of people who lost Romanian citizenship in the interwar period, and then the rights to reacquire Romanian citizenship from grandparents, parents, great-grandparents who lost Romanian citizenship in the kind of early Second World War. And so then kind of set this up as a comparison of, you know, there are many different ways in which kind of Crimea and Moldova share these similarities of contestation, kind of including in the post-Soviet period, this kind of existential questions in relation to identity politics. They share these kind of kin state policies that are available. But there's this kind of paradox that comes out, which is why, while kind of Crimea seems very important to Russia, kind of the pearl of Russia's national imaginary, Crimea didn't really seem a priority in terms of policy that Russia was putting out prior to Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014, whereas Romania has a different relationship to Moldova, it doesn't kind of see Moldova as a kind of pearl of the Romanian national imaginary. It sees it more as a kind of periphery to be Romanianized. But when it comes to policy, Romania is really prioritizing policies to Moldova and to Moldovan citizens. And so we might expect Russia to be doing different things in Crimea than it actually was doing. And so that there's kind of this paradoxical aspect of the comparison as well, which is then really interesting when we look from the bottom up, as I do in the later chapters.
Oh, definitely. I agree. And I think there's a lot of value in you putting this history on these cases and enlightening other readers, because even though it's kind of pertinent right now, it's in the news in a general way, there's not much we know about it, especially when you talk about Romania and what you're discussing. Now, I want to go in depth in chapter 4, which is called To Be Discriminated Against or Not in Crimea. Could you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, so I'll just kind of set the framework before discussing that chapter in depth. So I essentially have like four kind of in-depth empirical chapters. And the first two look at Crimea in terms of identity and citizenship. And then the second two look at Moldova in terms of identity and citizenship. So the chapter about to be discriminated against or not in Crimea is really a bottom-up examination of meanings of identification in Crimea based on fieldwork that I conducted in 2012 and 2013. And after kind of doing those fieldwork interviews and analyzing the data and realizing how much messiness and complexity there was when you kind of do that bottom-up examination, move away from kind of dichotomous understandings that people are necessarily Ukrainian or necessarily Russian, ethnically Ukrainian or ethnically Russian, and look more at how do people articulate and navigate what identity means for them? How do they talk about it? What is the meaning that they give to it? And come up with these kind of five inductive categories that help me to look at those meanings and kind of those agglomerations of meanings, and to examine who felt discriminated against and who did not feel discriminated against, and how did articulations of what it meant to be Russian intersect or not with that idea of discrimination? Because in, you know, during Russia's annexation of Crimea, the discourse coming out from the Russian state and from those supporting annexation on the ground in Crimea was very much that Russians have been discriminated against in Crimea. They've been threatened by Ukrainianization policies. And so it was really interesting then to kind of juxtapose that discourse with the data that I had from Crimea, kind of a window of calm before this moment in 2014. And so constructing those four inductive categories, I basically claim that it was only a minority of individuals who saw to be Russian as to be discriminated against by the state. And actually in the book, I describe them as politicized Russians, because I think it's really important that they don't just identify as ethnically Russian. And it's not just that they're the most pro-Russian participants that I engaged with, and it's not just that they identify as being discriminated against by Ukraine, it's also that they were politically active in pro-Russian movements, in pro-Russian parties. And so in a sense, this idea of being discriminated against is a political project of kind of those on the fringe, actually, of Crimean politics before 2014. And so rather annexation is kind of a moment where that fringe transforms into being this idea about what Crimea is. And instead, the four other categories that I construct really are kind of juxtaposed to that idea of discrimination. So the second category is about how it's possible to be ethnically Russian without having this idea of discrimination. And I have some quotes in the book about people kind of ridiculing this idea that they're discriminated against. Like, just because you have to watch cinema in Ukrainian language doesn't mean you're discriminated against, doesn't mean your rights are threatened. And then I look at kind of more hybrids and plural categories. So I look at a kind of small group of people that identified as Crimean. This kind of hybrid category articulated as a kind of way to be between Ukraine and Russia. And many people identified in that way because they had family that were ethnically Russian and ethnically Ukrainian. And this kind of regional identity of Crimea kind of allowed them to navigate that hybridity and that plurality. And then I look at this category that it took me a really long time to realize they existed, almost as if they shouldn't exist, because when we write about Crimea, we often think that everyone is identifying in an ethnic way. And instead, I look at this group of political Ukrainians, mostly young people who had grown up and kind of been educated and socialized during the post-Soviet period, and didn't want to talk about ethnicity, didn't see it as a way that they wanted to identify and define themselves. Rather, they wanted to talk about the importance of Ukrainian citizenship, of wanting to learn Ukrainian, of being kind of socialized within that Ukrainian state, and seeing Ukraine as a kind of very legitimate kind of state in which they resided. And then finally, I look at ethnic Ukrainians who hadn't really grown up in Crimea, but were living there through kind of various different reasons. And then kind of look at then how there are different ways in which people are identifying as Ukrainian in Crimea, some through that kind of political Ukrainian lens and some through that kind of ethnic Ukrainian lens, where it's almost they kind of didn't imagine it was possible to be ethnically Ukrainian and residing in Crimea, but it was definitely possible to be kind of politically Ukrainian and growing up in Crimea. I would say that, sorry, just one caveat to the book is that I'm looking at those who Russia would consider to be compatriots. So I don't look at Crimean Tatars, even though they are a super important community within Crimea. They're the kind of indigenous population to Crimea. Their rights have been really threatened. Since annexation, there's huge human rights abuses of Crimean Tatars, kidnaps, persecutions, murders. But I'm interested in that kind of spectrum between identifying as Russian and identifying as Ukrainian within that kind of who Russia would consider to be a compatriot of the state.
That's really interesting. And I think that in that chapter, there are elements for that are really useful for people trying to approach identity differently. The way you discuss generational changes and how senses don't always represent reality. Like there are a lot of things that escape those type of ciphers or figures and numbers when you're trying to understand identities. Now, I want to go to chapter number 5. Neither Russian citizens nor compatriots. Could you tell us about that, please?
So the sixth chapter is taking those meanings of identification and looking at how and if and why they might intersect with different practices of citizenship. So essentially what I'm doing is looking at who wanted Russian citizenship, who was interested in engaging with it, and how did that intersect with identity? And similarly, who identified as compatriots and who was interested in engaging with the compatriot policy? And to tell a kind of long story short, because I think the short story is basically the key message. In the beginning, I talked about how Crimea is often conceived as a case of Russian passportization, that there are many Russian citizens residing in Crimea and wanting Russian citizenship. The book is basically saying, I don't think that's the case. I never met anybody who had Russian citizenship, but I did meet people who were interested in acquiring it, a very small number, and they were politicized Russians. So only politicized Russians were interested in engaging in Russian citizenship, and they were lobbying the Russian state through the pro-Russian organizations that they were part of for Russian citizenship, and basically were having their calls unanswered. Kind of through that lobbying. And they wanted it because of that lens of discrimination. They saw themselves as discriminated and marginalized and saw Russian citizenship as a way to gain leverage within Crimea and within Ukraine. But they were the only people, basically, who saw Russian citizenship as desirable. Every other category, the ethnic Russians, the political Ukrainians, the Crimeans and the ethnic Ukrainians basically were like, we have zero interest in Russian citizenship. It doesn't give us what we need. It doesn't give us what we want. We don't want to move to Russia. We're super happy residing in Crimea within the Ukrainian state. We support territorial status quo. So in a sense, what I say is like identity does intersect somewhat with practices of citizenship in Crimea, but only to the extent that it's only discriminated, those who identify as discriminated, it's only politicized Russians that have any desire for Russian citizenship. For everyone else, identity is really not playing a factor, apart from the fact that they don't imagine themselves as discriminated. They're not in those pro-Russian organizations, and they have zero interest in engaging with the Russian state. And the same goes for the compatriot policy, that it was only politicized Russians who were interested in the compatriot policy and interested in identifying as compatriots. They were not happy with what the compatriot policy offered in terms of residency rights or kind of facilitated migration to Russia, because they saw that as kind of undermining their goals in Crimea, which was to have a strong pro-Russian community in Crimea. And also, they didn't want to move to somewhere colder and poorer than Crimea. They liked that, you know, Crimea is sunny and a nice place to live. And I look at, okay, so what is the compatriot policy then, if it's only of interest to those who identify as discriminated, identify as like the most pro-Russian and are part of these pro-Russian organizations? And what is interesting to reflect on is how other participants that weren't interested in the compatriot policy saw it as really as a scheme of corruption. That what Russia was offering through the compatriot policy was essentially leverage for politicized Russians. And they saw them not as really politicized Russians so much as professional Russians, that to be a part of those pro-Russian organizations, to see yourself as discriminated, was essentially a professional goal to get funds from Russia. And so they had zero interest in those kind of corruption schemes. They had zero interest in pro-Russian organizations because they saw them as political losers and corrupt individuals and organizations. And so you kind of had this big cleavage between the small group of politicized Russians and everyone else who has zero interest in Russian citizenship and zero interest in the compatriot policy. And I think that story of Crimea is really one that is not told, because what we see are those pro-Russian organizations. We see those pro-Russian individuals, and we assume that Crimea is pro-Russian and a space of pro-Russian nationalism on that basis. And what we don't see are the, in a sense, majority of people that I interviewed who had very little interest in Russia, were super critical of Russia, especially the Putin regime, especially the kind of corruption authoritarianism of the Putin regime, and supported Ukrainian kind of political and territorial, the status quo before annexation. They wanted to be a part and saw Ukraine as the legitimate government of Crimea. They wanted more integration with Ukraine, not kind of the goals of the pro-Russian movements. But even those pro-Russian movements, even the politicized Russians, saw annexation, saw any kind of territorial change as super unlikely and, to be honest, undesirable, because they couldn't foresee how it was possible or why Russia would pursue it. And so it's kind of interesting and kind of presents a paradox that, like, that moment just before annexation, it seemed completely unimaginable. And they really actually wanted to avoid conflict. They didn't want to pursue change that would lead to conflict and violence. And yet, kind of 8 months later, we see Russia's annexation of Crimea and the support of politicized or professional Russians for that annexation.
Great, Eleanor. Now, on chapter 6 and 7, there's this concept that you discuss around called nested identities. Could we start with chapter 6 called To Be Nested or Not in Moldova?
Mm-hmm. So similarly to the kind of bottom-up exploration of meanings of identification in Crimea, chapter 6 is doing the same and looking at bottom-up meanings of identification in Moldova. And you kind of already commented on the intergenerational kind of contestations of meanings. And that was something for me that was kind of fascinating. These Crimea and Moldova are similar in the sense of contestation, but they're also very different. One is a state, Moldova, and one is a sub-state, Crimea. And it was that kind of juxtaposition and seeing how they converged that was super interesting. And as I said, they kind of intersected in this intergenerational contestation of meaning, that people would have a very different understanding of their identity themselves. Their siblings might have a different understanding of identity if they were slightly older or younger, and they really saw their parents and grandparents as having different kind of meanings of identity. And I kind of explore the different ways in which that plays out. But primarily I look at, again, those meanings of identity from the bottom up and how those meanings are like messy, but they kind of agglomerate in these kind of groupings. And so I have five inductive categories of identification as well in Moldova. And the first is precisely that kind of nested category of organic Romanians who see to be Moldovan as to be Romanian, that there is basically no difference because they imagine a kind of biological and primordial connection to ethnic Romanians in Romania, that ethnic Romanians exist both in Moldova and in Romania, and there is basically no difference between them because of historical figures being related, because they imagine themselves as having the same blood as ethnic Romanians. And I kind of look at then how this idea of organic, to be organic Romanian, is kind of a nested articulation of identity with regards to Romania. But it's not the only way of identifying in Moldova. And so I also look at this category of cultural Romanians. So cultural Romanians they kind of contest the idea of organic Romanians, that there's kind of no difference. They don't imagine, they don't articulate no difference to ethnic Romanians in Romania. They do see like there's some kind of cross-cutting overlap. They do see their language as Romanian, but they don't, you know, to be ethnically Romanian in Moldova, they argue, is basically a different experience of being ethnically Romanian in Romania, because there's just a whole different political experience. Romania was never in the Soviet Union. It had never had kind of Soviet identity and nationality policies. And to be ethnically Romanian in Moldova and to be ethnically Romanian in Romania are still very different experiences, that Romania is much closer, is a member of the EU and therefore much closer to the EU. And there's just kind of a different political system in Moldova that makes that kind of fuses with that identity and makes people experience the world and understand themselves in very different ways. And then there's kind of ambivalent Romanians who kind of similarly have this idea of cross-cutting identification with ethnic Romanians in Romania and with Romania, but are much more uncertain about it and kind of don't want to have to decide how they identify. And they have this kind of ambiguity, that there's this kind of plurality, that like in some ways they identify as being Romanian, in some ways they identify as being Moldovan, but also don't really want to be forced to have to make a choice. And that ambivalence also plays out in relation to both the Romanian state and the Moldovan state, in the sense that, like, again, they don't want to choose, but also they kind of are super critical of both of those political systems and kind of try to navigate then those contestations. And then there's a category of Moldovans who kind of similarly to political Ukrainians, it's not that they identify as being ethnically Moldovan. That's not what's going on. It's a much more civic political understanding. They're often from more multicultural families. And they have a kind of separate understanding of themselves from ethnic Romanians in Romania, but really want to kind of underscore what's important is not ethnicity or language, but rather being from Moldova, being a citizen of Moldova, and kind of political ways of identifying with Moldova. And then lastly, there's this kind of fascinating and again politicized category of linguistic Moldovans, who are the only category that see the language that they speak as Moldovan. They are also from kind of multicultural families, and kind of hold on to this or kind of Soviet construction that to be Moldovan is in kind of competition with the Romanian state, that, well, or vice versa, that the Romanian state is kind of in competition with them as a Moldovan nation and seeking to kind of colonize it and intimidate what it means to be Moldovan, and they kind of want to be left alone to kind of to exist in that space. But it's a very politicized identity, in the sense that it is a kind of Soviet legacy, and it's the ways in which parties on the left in Moldovan politics have kind of reinvigorated the idea that there is no connection between Moldova and Romania, even though many people kind of identify in that way. And the book, in a similar way, the chapter, in a similar way to how I do in Crimea, is trying to look beyond census categories, that the Moldovan census allows people either to be ethnically Romanian or ethnically Moldovan or ethnically Russian or ethnically Ukrainian. But actually, those categories of ethnic Romanian and ethnic Moldovan don't get at the complexity of how people identify. And actually, in a sense, what do those categories mean in the first place if you have people, say, like ambivalent Romanians that don't want to have to make a choice? And so I look more at those meanings and contestations and navigations to say it's way more complex than these two categories. And actually, the ways in which we try to count those categories is too simplistic to get at what it means to be Romanian in the first place and what it means to be Moldovan in the first place as well.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's really interesting, and the fact that you look at the diversity within and the fact that identities are not monolithic. Now, could you tell us about chapter 7, from nested identities to nested citizens?
Mm-hmm. So whereas I say in the previous chapter that there isn't really a nested understanding, that there is a nested understanding of identity, but it's only for organic Romanians. When it comes to practices of citizenship, again, where I kind of intersect the meanings of identification with how people are engaging with Romania through citizenship, that's where you start to see that the identity isn't kind of the only thing that's going on, that people do have a kind of nested understanding of citizenship that extends beyond only organic Romanians, extends beyond only those who have a nested understanding of identity. And actually here, Moldovans are super interesting because they're very much interested to engage with Romanian citizenship, even though they don't really see Romania as a kin state, even though they don't see themselves as in any way ethnically Romanian. And so I kind of look at how and why the kin state of Romania is able to engage with those who really don't want to identify as ethnically Romanian. But the chapter is also trying to kind of question a typical argument that is put forward, that people in Moldova only want Romanian citizenship for what is described as kind of strategic or material reasons, which is to say that, and I don't discount or underplay this, that Romanian citizenship is EU citizenship. It is access to a different labour market, to greater rights in the international system and the EU in particular. And Moldova was peripheralised by Romania acceding to the EU, and there has been a gold rush of Romanian citizenship since. But I try to question that it's not only about the material value of Romanian citizenship that is kind of explaining what's going on. And conversely, it's also not just about identity, right? I already kind of said that many more people in Moldova were engaging with Romanian citizenship that identified as ethnically Romanian, and that kind of saw Romanian citizenship in that symbolic sense. And again, kind of moving away from that spectrum of it can only be symbolic or only material, look at how those logics might be combined. And also this kind of third logic that I talk about of legitimacy, because I think to explain the popularity of Romanian citizenship, we also need to understand how normal it is, how constructed as natural it is to be a Romanian citizen in Moldova, how this isn't just a kind of everyday thing that ordinary people are doing. It's also a very endorsed political practice. So a lot of political elites have Romanian citizenship, judges, you know, kind of everyone in Moldovan society is engaging with Romanian citizenship. And it's not something that is contested really, apart from those on the left in Moldova. And instead, it is about how it's constructed as normal, how it's constructed as legitimate, and how it's constructed as natural. Because just like Romania frames a policy as reacquisition, people also understand it for its kind of reparative correction of historical injustices that they can directly tie to their family members. So they are getting it back as a consequence of their parents, grandparents, great-grandparents losing Romanian citizenship because of Soviet annexation of Moldova from Romania. And so they kind of see those rights as, you know, they have a right to those rights, that those rights are theirs, and they have every right to be acquiring those rights and to be applying for them and engaging with them, that that is legitimate. And so I try to then say that many more people see Romanian citizenship as legitimate than necessarily see it as for its material reasons or see it for its symbolic reasons. And I think we need to take seriously not just that the different logics of symbolic and material might be intersecting, but also that the legitimacy of Romanian citizenship is another kind of intersecting logic, and I think in many ways a more powerful logic for why Romanian citizenship is so important and attractive in Moldova during this period.
That's really interesting, Ellie. Now, before we go into the final chapter called Identity, Citizenship, and Kin Majorities, I want you to tell us a bit about the table of contents and figures in the book, because what you're discussing, there's a level of complexity to it, yet you managed to explain it clearly. And I think you make good use of those tables and figures. In general, could you tell us what you did with it, how you used them to explain all these complexities?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think probably my favorite figures in the book are the maps, which are at the very, very beginning. And, you know, I did my undergrad in geography. I've been a lover of maps for a really long time because I think that they are able to convey something that, you know, that they're able to distill complexity in a way that is like visually beautiful and super powerful for showing how dynamic borders have been over kind of short but long time spans, right? We're talking about, you know, if it's still possible to be alive in Moldova or to be alive in Crimea and have existed during those often violent and conflict-driven border changes yourself, that kind of borders have moved over people as much as people have moved over borders. So yeah, I really, really love the maps. But in the tables, you know, especially in the empirical chapters, I kind of try to condense what is that kind of messy and complex story into something that is kind of, as I say, distilled, right? That it's synthesizing information in a way that is trying to convey a messy story and a complex story in a kind of single articulation of it to synthesize those similarities and differences and to look theoretically and analytically at what this means. Like, what do these meanings of identification mean? Theoretically, what do these practices of citizenship mean and how are they kind of then intersecting?
That's so interesting. Now, let's go in depth in chapter 8, Identity, Citizenship, and Kin Majorities. I think you've wrapped things up in that chapter. Can you tell us about it, please?
Yeah, so, I mean, I was thinking in a way, like, is this the hardest chapter I wrote or the easiest chapter I wrote? Because in a way, like, I set out for this bottom-up comparative study, and the empirical chapters allow me to kind of drill into, you know, meanings of identification in Crimea, practices of citizenship in Crimea and vice versa in Moldova. And essentially chapter 8 is trying to bring all of this empirical complexity, messiness, plurality together to say, okay, but what is, you know, where is the comparison? And I really believe that comparison is like trying to be more than the sum of its parts. And so you kind of have to do that, right, through a side-by-side analysis. And so this chapter is really trying to do that kind of bottom-up comparison. So I look first at meanings of identification and the ways in which Crimea and Moldova converge and diverge. And kind of what I say is that there's actually a surprising amount of convergence in terms of how meanings of identification are understood, that they are, you know, I start with this category of kin majorities and say, actually, when we look from the bottom up, it's not that the kin majority doesn't exist, but it's way more complex, and that actually majorities are assemblages of different kind of constituent understandings of identity. And again, kind of going away from that, people are either ethnically Ukrainian or ethnically Russian or ethnically Romanian or ethnically Moldovan, say that, you know, there's different assemblages of how people understand themselves historically, politically, territorially, culturally, etc. And so, again, one of the ways in which these two cases kind of converge is around that intergenerational contestation of meaning. And that's kind of another layer of complexity, right? That there isn't just variation across within meanings, there's also variation across time of how people understand themselves in relation to their parents and grandparents and children. And then try to kind of explore how and why Crimea kind of converge in that way. But when we come to practices, we see a very different story, right? Whereas they kind of converge in terms of complexity of meanings, how those meanings then play out in terms of whether people are interested in citizenship from a kin state is really different. And what I try to do to bring together, you know, why is Romanian citizenship so popular in Moldova and Russian citizenship surprisingly unpopular in Crimea, is not just because of what the states are doing. It's not just because Romania is making Romanian citizenship available in Moldova and Russia really wasn't facilitating access of Russian citizenship to Crimea. I don't think the story would necessarily be that different if Russia had made Russian citizenship more available before annexation, because we also need to look from the bottom up. We need to look at how legitimate those policies are. And as I said, Romanian citizenship was understood as being super legitimate in Moldova, that people wanted those rights back from their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents that had lost them, whereas Russian citizenship was not conceived as legitimate in Crimea. It didn't have that kind of reparative function. People didn't see those rights as being lost. And it was in direct kind of contradiction to what was legal within Ukraine. But again, I don't necessarily think the legitimacy of Russian citizenship would have looked that different if it was legal. I think that people didn't have that kind of family narrative as to or sense of loss regarding Russian citizenship in Crimea, that the Ukrainian state had quite successfully built a political identity around kind of legitimacy of governance over Crimea. And I also look at desirability, that Romanian citizenship was super desirable in Moldova because it gave people rights that they wanted and needed and saw as legitimate, whereas people in Crimea just did not see Russian citizenship as desirable. They didn't want essentially the rights or need the rights that Russian citizenship might have offered, apart from those politicized Russians that I talk about, who did want Russian citizenship, who did think that they needed Russian citizenship and were unable to get it. But they were a very small community. They were politically active in those kind of fringe pro-Russian movements and wanted it as leverage against the state of Ukraine. So the final chapter is really kind of doing that comparative work and then kind of looking out to say, okay, what are the broader implications of the book in terms of identity, citizenship, and how we study post-Soviet politics? And in terms of identity, the importance of looking beyond dichotomous kind of categories and doing that bottom-up work, looking at those meanings, because essentially those categories can become redundant when we look from the bottom up and we kind of have to question what census categories mean in the first place. The importance of studying practices of citizenship, that it's not just about what states make available and accessible, it's also about how people conceive of what those citizenship policies mean and look like for them, and whether they want them and whether they see them as legitimate. And then also shift to, it's a kind of self-reflection and self-criticality to say, maybe we need to not just look at identity and nationalism with regards to post-Soviet politics, because actually what this book is also about exposing is looking at the fusion of, say, identity and nationalist politics with corruption in Crimea, and how kind of these cleavages of identity are not really that meaningful when we look from the bottom up. They are a kind of veil for corruption. They allow elites to kind of continue to talk about questions of identity and nationalism and to get away without kind of solving some of the bigger questions around inequality and corruption. And so that kind of top down, bottom up juxtaposition of saying, we also need to kind of look beyond what the state is doing in terms of how we study these states and societies and people, and look at more what they consider important as well, both in terms of how we study identity and citizenship, but also how we study other things that aren't just the kind of top-down cleavages in politics.
That's so interesting. I think the individual plays an important role and how you explained these identities. And I also believe that you're very critical of myth-making or mythical origins in regards to identities. And among many other things that I find really valuable in your book in general, we've been discussing your book, Identity and Citizenship in Crimea and Moldova. And Dr. Eleanor Nutt, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I have just two final questions for you, please. First one is, what are you working on right now? And the second one is, how do you think this has changed in the present with all the turmoil in Europe in general and Russia in particular? How has that changed? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Let me actually answer the second question first. Because I think the changes, in the last 8 years have really affected what it is possible to work on. And so it's kind of shifted my research agenda as a consequence. So I would just reiterate that, like, when I left Crimea in May, June 2013, I had probably more importantly, the people that I was interviewing, friends, acquaintances, had absolutely no sense that what was about to happen in February 2014 was about to happen. They saw it as undesirable, essentially. And so we also need to look at then kind of what changed in that 8 to 9 month period. But I think after 2014, it became impossible for me to go back to Crimea. And I've published about that in a piece, Beyond the Field, because it is not safe for me to be asking those kinds of questions about what it means to be ethnically Russian, how people engage with Russia, what Russia means as a kin state, whether people conceive of Russia as a kin state. But more importantly, it would be super unsafe for me to, that the participants that I might have in that kind of hypothetical study would be put at grave risk. So very quickly, I realized that as Russia's annexation of Crimea was happening and as rights were being kind of suppressed on the ground in Crimea, that would just not be an avenue that I would do future research. And, I had many kind of projects in mind about, I think it would have been really interesting to shift away from just studying ethnic Russians and ethnic Ukrainians in Crimea to also look at Crimean Tatars. But again, it is not safe for me as a foreign researcher to do that kind of work. And I would say since February 2022, so this year, the numbers of people that are unable to do this kind of work is growing, right? That it is not safe in any way to travel to sites of active conflict for the researcher or for potential participants. I think a lot of researchers I know that work on Russia are basically unable to continue kind of empirical on the ground work, including those kind of Russian citizens as well. So I think this war has kind of changed everything in terms of what it is possible to study. I think it is possible to do kind of desk-based work, but that is not kind of why I got into wanting to be a researcher. Like, I think field research is the most beneficial of all the ways to collect data when it's safe to do so. Desk-based research is a kind of poor sibling of that kind of approach. But in this consequence, like, it's not harming anybody to do that. And so one of the things that I've been working on is kind of drawing on the implications of the book to look at different explanations for Russia's annexation of Crimea. A lot of people have suggested that it's around nationalism, it's around the support for annexation within Crimea. And I try to say, okay, that's one explanation, but it needs to be tested against other explanations, including the role of organized crime and corruption. Because if the people that I talk about in the book as politicized Russians, if the people that have taken over Crimea since 2014 are, yes, pro-Russian nationalists, but also highly involved in organized crime and corruption, at what point are they pro-Russian nationalists and at what point are they organized criminals? And is there a kind of organized crime story around annexation that we also need to consider? More broadly, I've been doing work on citizenship in relation to democratization in post-communist Europe and also in relation to Brexit. So one thing that I was kind of reflecting on the very early period in which the, you know, after the referendum for the UK to leave the EU and the slight majority of voters that supported leaving the EU was looking at the consequences and understandings and meanings and practices of EU citizenship and living in the UK for the 3 million population of EU citizens that reside in the UK and kind of how they understand what Brexit is and the implications of that on their kind of citizenship status and security in the UK. And then also I'm super interested, not only because I work in the Department of Methodology, but just in general around kind of methodological questions. So I've been working a bit on research ethics. And then more recently, I've been writing a paper on what I describe as kind of methodologies of intuition, how our prior experiences and insights play a really important role in the decisions that we make around research and how we design research, but they're often not something, at least in political science, that we expose to readers. They're often something that we kind of hide away from because we think it's more rigorous to do so. And I try to make the argument that actually kind of drawing on cognitive debates and cognitive psychology and organizational behavior, that actually there is much greater rigor in exposing the contingencies, uncertainties, and the role of intuition in the way that we do and design and conduct research than there is in kind of hiding it in the shadows. So yeah, I'm definitely working on a lot of different things at this point. But yeah, it's nice to kind of to have the space after the book to do those kind of different research interests as well.
That's really interesting, Dr. Eleanor. Not all those projects sound interesting as a reader, and I'm looking forward to, you know, reading them. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. Take care. And to the audience, thanks for listening to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.